danger.
Greetings, pilgrims, and welcome to episode 69 of the Innsmouth Book Club. As you can see, once again, we've brought you into the lobby of the Gilman Hotel, where we're going to go upstairs and meet our guests for today. I'm one of your guides, Rob Poynton.
And I'm the other one, Tim Mendes. Yes, we've been joined all the way from sunny Wiltshire by Mr. Simon Bleakin. So, yeah, let's mount the creaky stairs and go and say hello, shall we?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, actually, last time we were here, they were decorating.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking around now, it looks as shabby and run down as decayed as it did before. What's that about?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they were cleaning the shog-off slime off the skirting boards or something. I don't know.
All right, here we go. Up to room 428. And here's our guest for today. It's Mr. Simon Bleakin. Hi, Simon. How are you doing?
Hello, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, all good.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, so is this your first visit to Innsmouth?
I've crept in and out a few times over the years, but I've never stayed after dark.
Wise.
But I hear the bus has broken down, so who knows?
Yeah, that's how they get you. What we do now is we bring bicycles, you see, so we can cycle out. But you get to experience the full delights of Innsmouth at night.
Sounds nice.
So perhaps we can start with a little bit about your background, where you're from and so on, and how you got into sort of weird fiction and Lovecraft in particular.
Yeah, well, as you know, I live in Wiltshire. I'm originally from Bristol, and I got into Lovecraft about age 15 is when I started reading him, but I got into him a lot before then because growing up I liked horror fiction, I liked weird things, I liked very interested in ghosts and supernatural and strange stories. I used to read a lot of Poe, Blackwood, Mack and things like that, and became a huge fan, as I think as I mentioned to him once before, of Ghostbusters, which got me into the real Ghostbusters.
Oh yes.
And about 12 I watched an episode called The Collect Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
And since then, I still keep wanting to say Cthulhu rather than Cthulhu, but we can't pronounce it anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
And it just lodged a seed in my head. And when I was a little bit older, I went looking for Lovecraft and ended up buying the omnibus editions, which had very interesting covers, piles of heads and naked women, and ghouls. And I loved them. Yeah, absolutely loved them.
Yeah, there was one, wasn't there, with a pile of heads and like a woman falling down this like abyss sort of tunnel thing. I remember that vividly in my head.
And a big Nurgle thing that was eating her, yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's something that's ever been covered, actually. People talk a lot about Frazetta and sort of sword and sorcery art, but perhaps we need to do an episode on Lovecraft art for books. There's some interesting stuff there.
There is.
Yeah, that'll be good. But yeah, so from there I got into Clark Ashton Smith, which was a revelation, really. He needed a dictionary, but the way he paints with words was incredible. And then Robert E. Howard, Henry Kuttner, and so on. And I was also into a lot of Stephen King, and I still am. So I try to, with my work, I try to combine my love of the old style with some of the new and see where it takes me.
Yeah. And when did you first start writing? What prompted you to first start writing?
I got into, a friend was interested in writing and I tagged along with him to a writer's circle. And I thought, well, you know, I love stories. I always have. I love hearing stories. I've always loved telling stories, but I'd never thought of doing anything with it. So I had a go. I was about, I think, 15, 16. And I started sending things off. I think the first thing I had was a young author's magazine at the age of 60, you know, starting out the right way piece, which was a load of rubbish, really. But it was my first sort of toe in the water, really. After that, I started signing up to newsletters and things and sending things out to Cracked Mirror Mysteries and places like that. I sort of haunted the small press. And eventually, I sort of put it on hold for a while because I got into other things like evening classes and life kind of took over. But in the last 8, 9 years or so, I've been pushing to get back into it and really do something with my writing.
Yeah, it's a very, very similar sort of tale to a lot of people. They start out writing quite early and then life gets in the way. It's exactly what happened to me, you know, like go catering college and all this sort of stuff just got in the way. And then after a while, it's just like, you know what, this is what I really want to do.
For me, it was Ancient Egypt I had a love of ancient Egypt. So I used to do evening classes at Bristol University and had dreams of going off to uni that never quite happened, but it's there as a passion now, so.
And did you get out to Egypt at all? Have you been to the
Been a
pyramids?
few times, yeah.
Oh,
It's
wow.
20 years ago now. It's,
Yeah.
I've got a job and a mortgage. It doesn't happen these days.
Oh, well, yeah, and travel has been somewhat curtailed, hasn't it, over the last few years
Yeah.
for one reason. And from what I hear, the outskirts of Cairo are literally right up to the edge of the pyramids now, pretty
It's
much.
bizarre. There's a McDonald's and then there's the pyramid. It's really strange. Yeah. All the photos are pointing one way for a reason.
Yeah, I have often wondered that, why it's always from the
Yeah.
same angle. That makes a lot of
There's a
sense.
very good reason for that.
Right.
You turn around and there's a building, so.
I think that kind of twists my melon a bit. If you look out your bedroom window and you can see the Great Pyramid, it's like a bit of a sort
The Great
of
Pyramid and then a
mindfuck,
Starbucks.
isn't it? If you go somewhere like Saqqara, you get a bit more of an authentic feel. That's further out, so it feels a bit more isolated.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, the pyramids are right on top of Cairo. It's a bit of a shame, but if you're staying in Cairo, you don't have far to go.
Well, there is
Yeah,
that.
yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to do that old hire the guides sort of thing anymore, I suppose. You just
Yeah,
catch a bus.
imprisoned with the pharaohs. There we go.
Yes, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Though they don't let you on the top of the pyramids anymore, unfortunately. Not that I'd want to fight someone on top of a pyramid.
No, I can think of better places to have a punch up than
Yeah.
on top of a pyramid.
Macclesfield on a Saturday night.
Yeah, Macclesfield. There you go.
So, does your love of Egyptology and the Lovecraftian kind of tie in together? There's obviously some connections there. Did they sort of come about at the same time, or did one lead to the other?
Yeah, I think Lovecraft, it was about the same time, to be honest. And yeah, I did enjoy reading it's Imprisoned with the Pharaohs or Under the Pyramids, whatever you want to call it. Yeah, definitely. And I think it does help as well, having an interest in ancient history. If you're building an alien or a fantasy civilization, you can draw on fragments from different cultures and different times and put them together. And I think that definitely comes into it.
Yeah. And we always say, don't we, Tim, that's one of the beauties of, well, weird fiction in general, but Lovecraft in particular. You can put it into any setting you like, any time in history or future or anything, really.
Yeah, sort of the themes of cosmic horror you can just put anywhere you like, and that's something I've always liked about it. I've always like have a game with myself of trying to find the what's the strangest place I could put some cosmic horror, back room of a supermarket or
As I say, sometimes it's when it's least expected is when it works most effectively.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's do you see that recent film, Glorious? It's ridiculous, but I loved it. It's a low budget American horror film, and it's he's basically on a road trip, and he stops off this roadside truck stop thing, and he goes into the stalls to do his business, and there's a glory hole, and there's a cosmic horror on the other side of this glory hole, an eldritch abomination, which then traps him in this thing. And the whole thing is this guy's interaction with an eldritch abomination through a glory hole. It's ridiculous, but it's well worth a watch.
That one up.
It's genius in a way, and as well.
Exactly. This is it.
So, truck stops and glory holes aside, do you have like a favourite setting for your own stories? Do you tend to work in a modern setting, or do you mix things up?
I like to vary it. I mean, I do everything from sort of science fiction to fantasy to sort of modern day to back in the 30s, the 20s. It seems to be just whatever the story calls for. But I think that having the variety really just helps, it stops the stories from feeling the same as well if you can
Yeah.
do a different setting each time. And I like to try and push myself with each story. So you don't want everything to be too samey. Just try a different setting, try a different genre, try a different time. But yeah, I think most of what I do has horror in it, whether it's got a fantasy setting or a science fiction setting. I recently did a story for Hellbound Books, which was Infinity's Embrace, and that's a cosmic horror, but it's set on a starship charting the middle of the galaxy down by Sagittarius A, the supermassive black hole.
Nice,
Nice,
yeah.
awesome.
I mean, in some ways, I don't know. Tim's got some views on this, following one of his anthologies, but the space setting is ideal for cosmic horror, because you're already very much in the cosmos as a very small speck, you know. That yeah. feeling of irrelevance is already there, isn't it? But it doesn't necessarily make... I was thinking of you and your... How many submissions for your cosmic
horror? Well, the thing is, I had like nearly 300 submissions for it, but I don't know what happened. There was a lot of people who didn't understand there was a difference between little green men and cosmic horror. So I got a lot of UFO abductions and alien. I got so many anal probes in that submission window. It was ridiculous. but yeah, the ones that, you know, set in space that do have the cosmic horror element, not just alien invasion stuff, because there is a big difference.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And I guess an example, the best example of that certainly on film would be Alien itself, right?
Yeah, yeah. Event Horizon would be another good example.
That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, it's a great film.
And when you're writing science fiction, I mean, I've touched on science fiction in a short story or two, and I did a couple of novels that were like military science fiction, which isn't really science fiction because it's just Sven Hassel in space, you know, kind of thing or whatever. How far do you go into the science, or do you just say they've got a warp drive and that's it?
They've got a warp drive and that's it. I focus more on the story, and the world is just there to support the story.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a pretty big fan of Doctor Who and Star Trek, so and Alien and, you know, things like that. And it's pretty much just assume that they've got faster than light travel, they've got starships, and it's that's just the setting for the story mostly. So whether purists would say that is sci-fi, I don't know, but I call it sci-fi.
No, I would totally agree, because again, this is something we've talked about before. We're both big fans of Doctor Who, and I come to sci-fi from that end of it as well, where it's not really explained. It's all pseudoscience. Yeah. It's, you know, there's a thing that can go faster than light. Yeah, great. It's a big difference. I've never really managed to get into that hard sci-fi where they go into minute details about everything. I guess it's horses for courses, isn't it? It's what you're into. But I like what you say there. It's more the story-driven end of sci-fi that appeals.
Definitely, you know? Yeah. It's there to serve the story, not the story there to serve the science. And it's where can it take you? Where can your imagination go next?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same as any location thing, isn't it? It's it just opens up the horizons even more because you can come up with all kinds of weird and wonderful flora and fauna to sort of augment your story. We don't need to know how it grows or what soil it's in, you know?
Yeah.
One thing around that, something we often say about Clark Ashton Smith is his aliens are usually really alien, aren't they? It's not the Star Trek bloke in a suit kind of job.
No. But there's also, I mean, it's talking about Clark Ashton Smith, is it the vaults of Jovombis, where it's almost alien-like, there's things on the heads, and, you know, that's just a brilliant story. And that for me is an example of, he's not worried about the science behind how they got out there, he's worried about what happens when they get there.
Yeah.
And it's worth the journey.
It's a tremendous story, yeah. I mean, most of his, can never remember the title of it. Was it The Immeasurable Horror? The one that's that big, like, proto-Shoggothy thing.
The big Shoggoth on Venus.
That keeps growing on Venus. I love that. There's just something about that. It's just a superb story. But again, he spends, like, maybe a paragraph on the voyage there, and then they're there, and there you go. That's all. Yeah. That's what it's about.
Being there is the important part, definitely.
And I suppose there's two things there about the weird tale. One is that not everything is explained. There's always that element. But also that idea of atmosphere above everything else. And with Lovecraft, I mean, sometimes it's a criticism levels at Lovecraft that it's all atmosphere and very little character. So where do you stand on that sort of balance?
I've always gone with atmosphere first. I think if you've got a story with a good atmosphere, that's everything, really, especially in weird fiction. I think it's what separates it in a way from horror is that the atmosphere is such a character in itself. I mean, I'm thinking here of going back to Clark Ashton Smith again, sorry, but The Abominations of Yondu is a story that I love. I love the opening paragraph,
yes,
where he talks about how the desert is, the meteorites, all of that. The plot is wafer thin, but you're not really there for the plot. You're there for the way he paints with language and the atmosphere and the journey it takes you on.
Yeah.
When really it's just a guy running across the desert, gets scared and runs back again.
But yeah,
that's it.
Yeah.
It's the whole atmosphere that makes the story. In my opinion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Totally. And again, in that, he creates a whole backstory for the world in a paragraph. And it's,
yeah,
you want to know more about it. You know, it's so engrossing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of Clark Ashton Smith's biggest strengths, is his ability to convey a hell of a lot in a very short, short amount of words. You know, the amount of, you know, other people would spend a couple of pages to get across what he gets across in a paragraph. Yeah, I think it's tremendous.
And he had a vocabulary like no other.
Oh, yeah, don't we know it?
Yeah, when it comes to pronunciations and everything else, then that's something else. But I think both of us feel that reading Smith, as we've been doing for Strange Shadows, has enriched our vocabularies immeasurably.
Immeasurably so, yeah.
And in a most audacious fashion.
Indeed. Yeah, to the point where we've started, it's become a game now when we do stories to try and get the most Smithian phrase or word in there. You know, so we have fulgurance, pecuniary depletion, all this kind of stuff gets thrown around, doesn't it? You know.
And speaking of that, I think we've shared pages, haven't we, in an anthology or two. I think in The Shadow Over Doggerland.
Yep, that's one, yeah. That was
And Lovecraftiana, Dear Old Gavin's, yes, magazine. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah. And,
I've been in a few episodes, issues of Schlock as well, which has been it's a really good magazine, or webzine, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. But it's really good to, these past few years especially, I've really begun to make a lot of contacts within the writing community, and it's great to meet everyone and be on things like this, you know, which wouldn't have happened before, which is nice.
Well, yeah, we've found it, you know, it's overall, I'd say 99% is a very supportive community.
Yeah, which definitely,
which to us harkens back to that whole sort of Lovecraft circle or Smithian circle or whatever you want to call it. Everyone seemed very supportive of everyone else.
Yeah.
It's a good atmosphere.
Yeah. And you know, it's like for myself doing anthologies and Rob doing anthologies, the sort of enthusiasm of people to when you invite them to play in your sandbox, it is like, to me, it is harking back to that sort of Lovecraft circle thing of like, oh, I've got this. Do you want to play with it? There you go. Off you go. Play with the Hounds of Tinderloss for a bit, you know. Oh, well, you can have Yig. There you go. Sort of thing, you know. It's it is really cooperative in that sort of way. And there's no, there doesn't seem to be much sort of like catty sort of a competition, you know. It's like we're all going towards the same goal, I think, which is great. Yeah, madness. Yeah, exactly.
And it is nice to be able to create your own things, but also draw on what exists.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, I think of other fandoms like, say, Star Trek, which I'm a huge fan, but they're so fighting all the time over canon, what's official and what's not. But here it's just like, yeah, go with it. Have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And it's a nice feeling. Nice feeling.
And if you get into Lord of the Rings fandom, then you need to have a degree in Gondorian history. You know, heaven forbid you get the colour of the badge wrong or something. Or no, there should be 13 leaves, not 12, on the standard and all that kind of thing. It's quite something. Yeah.
I'm too scared to go near it.
Yeah, same. I stayed well away from most of that kind of fandom. I used to be heavily involved in Doctor Who fandom back in the sort of 90s and early 2000s, and I ran away from that because it started getting really like, you know. So, well, the Virgin New Adventures aren't canon, and that's not canon. Oh, God, I'm out.
But canon must be very difficult in things like Doctor Who and Star Wars and all this, because they've been created by so many different people.
Exactly.
Whereas at least Tolkien, J.R.R.R., Christopher Tolkien, that's it, you know.
Yeah.
And I think with Lovecraft, you can do pretty much anything, can't you, really?
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's ever said, you can't have Cthulhu fighting Godzilla. Well, you can if you want. It doesn't doesn't seem to matter.
Because it almost doesn't work if you try and define it too closely anyway, because the whole point is it's meant to be unknowable. Because that's what makes it scary, is you can never really get a handle on it.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, there was contradictions in Lovecraft's own work. You know, there were certain things he'd say about, say, Nyarlathotep in one story that would contradict what he'd say in the other. But that was a conscious thing because of, like, organized religion and things like that, and the contradictions that exist in all that. It makes it seem more real. So, you know, I've always thought of that when it comes to that kind of thing. It's just like, well, you know, if Lovecraft could contradict himself, then...
It does give us a lot more freedom, which is good. And you're right, because myths and things, they always change and they shift and they distort over time, and it makes them more interesting.
Exactly, yeah.
In that sense, then, do you think that what we could see in a Lovecraftian story today would be, or do you take Lovecraft's themes and you adapt them for a modern sensibility on all sorts of levels? I mean, in one sense, cosmic is timeless, but in the other sense, the way we come to it is perhaps through a different lens from 100 years ago or whatever.
Well, I remember I read somewhere someone saying that they thought it was harder to do that kind of fiction in the modern age, where you've got CCTV cameras everywhere, everyone's got a smartphone. It's harder to isolate people. It's harder to find corners of the world that haven't been intruded upon. And I suppose in a sense that's true, but it's still possible. And that's part of the challenge now, I think, is to find new ways to tell those stories in the world we know today.
Yeah, I think it gives you an opportunity, because then you can play with these new toys. You know, you can have something infiltrate in the internet or in the CCTV or the cosmic horror in the phone. You know, I don't think it really matters. I mean, to isolate people, I mean, I've come up with some real MacGuffins to get rid of mobile phones and things like that, but you know, once you've dealt with it, it's fine, isn't it? You know,
yeah. And if you live where I do, you can see that cell signal isn't always that great anyway, so
exactly.
That's it. I was just going to say that, and in a sense there can be just as much sense of isolation even if you're connected to the internet, or perhaps a feeling of isolation if you lose that connection. You know, you lose your phone signal. This, you know, there's even a thing. I went out a few weeks ago and I left my phone at home, and it's like, oh shit! You know, it's that's how pervasive this stuff is now.
Yeah, I guess you could say Lovecraft would have carried on writing if he was still alive today. He'd be using the modern world just as we are. So it's just an evolution, isn't it? Really,
definitely. Yeah.
So something else we talk about is this idea of we're creating horrors or horrible situations, and we live in a world where there's plenty of horrible stuff going on. How do we get that balance? This was highlighted to me. In fact, just this morning, I was looking at one forum, and they've banned talk of the mini sub that has gone missing by the Titanic, because people were saying, "Ah, deep ones." And someone pointed out that there's people in this, you know, this is happening now.
Maybe
in a year's time. I don't know. So how does that work for you, maintaining that balance between creating a horror or creating a feeling of horror and actually disturbing people, I suppose?
Yeah, I kind of approach it as almost like a dark fantasy kind of. I don't worry too much about trying to tie it into real world events in that sense. I think that I just tell the stories that come to me, and I don't try and base them on anything that's going on. I mean, I've never done stories, for example, around, say, school shootings or anything like that, because that just feels a bit too raw and real. But I guess in time, anything is eventually up for grabs, isn't it? With enough time having passed, you know, things fade into history and then it becomes sort of fair game, it seems.
Yeah.
But I don't actually read the news much either, so I don't really base a lot of stories on the news. I find it too depressing, so I tend to just pick it up through Facebook usually. But generally, if it's too hot and too fresh, I try and do something to distract people from the terrible things that are going on in the world by giving them other terrible things to enjoy. If that makes sense.
I totally agree with you that. It was like during the pandemic, it was probably my most prolific period, because I basically just sat down and wrote for the entirety of it, just to take my mind off all the hell that was going on outside, right? And there was a publisher And they were like, oh, we're going to do pandemic stories. And I was like, are you insane? It's like nobody is going to buy that. Nobody's going to want to write for that. You know, we want things to take our minds off it. I mean,
we've had enough of that.
Yeah, fiction is an escape, right? You don't want to be reading about the nightmare that you're living in, do you? It's just... Ugh. No.
Maybe 10 years down the line when it's a memory, but
yeah.
And I think there's an old saying that when times are hard, people turn to escapism and fantasy.
Exactly.
I mean, I think I saw recently Games Workshop have had a 15% increase in profits. Mm. I think that kind of stuff. Warhammer is just everywhere. I'm going to a gaming club on a Monday night. They've seen an 80% rise in membership and, you know, so people do seem to turn to these things in order to escape the real world horrors, yeah. I suppose.
The irony for me was 3 years ago, I hadn't heard of, well, I wasn't really into podcasts, the irony of being on a podcast and saying that. But then I found out about something called The White Vault and I got into that and I found all these other things. And so now I'm quite into podcasts. Yeah. But before the pandemic, no, just hadn't found them.
Yeah. Same here. And I think, again, that's a technology thing as well, isn't it? Now you can record studio level music at home. You can video on your phone. People make films on a phone, right? You know, it's all available to us, which from a creative point of view is great.
I'd never done a Zoom call before the pandemic. I didn't even know what Zoom was. I remembered Skype from back in the day, but I'd never done Zoom, you know.
It's amazing how well it's come along as well. It's come along so quickly. It's really good.
So you've had quite a few stories there now. You've been published in a lot of different books and that. Do you think there's been an increase in sort of small press publications, an increase in weird fiction and Lovecraftian works?
I think there has in recent years been more of an increase. And I think also, as the technology of the internet has developed, it's become easier to find people, it's become easier to find submissions, it's become easier to get your work out there. And as I said, I discovered podcasts a few years ago, and then I discovered something called the No Sleep Podcast, which I'm not plugging it, but it's really good. And I've had quite a few stories on there in the past few years.
Yep.
And so that's made it, it's surprising how things have changed and moving on. But then again, of course, there's the bad sides of technology, all this fear about AI and, you know, computer-generated writing and art. And so it's a balance, really, isn't it, between using it for good and the possibility of it being a problem. But again, it's good story potential, though.
It's Nyarlathotep, you know, we can always see the AI in the middle of it.
Yeah.
It's a hot potato at the moment, isn't it, on a lot of Facebook groups, the AI argument.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. There's a lot of fear as well. Will it replace writers and will it do? And hopefully it'll just settle down and become something else that's just there. But we'll see.
Yeah. I'm hoping it'll become like the synthesizer, because there was all this panic with synthesizers, wasn't there, back in the day? It's taking money off real musicians and all this kind of business. But it just became another tool that people had. So I'm hoping, you know, that it's because I know a lot of artists, like very, very well-known, well-respected artists who do use the AI to aid in composition and almost like as a mock-up.
Yeah.
So they can see how their idea would look from a composition point before they go off and actually draw it. I think if used correctly, then it could be a good thing.
Yeah, definitely. As long as it's not relied upon to, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of writing, I've seen some people have put things like, describe going shopping in a supermarket in M.R. James style or something like that.
It was Gavin. So, it was Gavin Chappell. He did a whole series of them in like H.P. Lovecraft Ghost of the Post Office.
I remember seeing those, yeah. Robert E. Howard one as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, which can be, that's like a fun thing. Yeah. But I think... we're back to that idea of atmosphere again. I think to do a piece of copywriting for a new whatever, AI can be fine. But I struggle to see at the moment how it could create that atmosphere because it's not just about what words you use, it's kind of how you use them.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyone who puts, anything out on Facebook or published or anything else is going to draw reviews and comments. How are you with reviews? Do you sort of hunt down your reviews and look at them, or do you totally ignore them, or how do you?
Every now and then I will creep onto Google and I will just see if there's anything new and just have a look. I haven't had too many so far. Just random things now and then you think, really? But most of the time they've been pretty good. But I do sneak on and have a look. I probably shouldn't. But yeah, I just forget sometimes because I'm so busy writing new stories, you forget to go back and look at the old ones. But
yeah. Definitely.
And I almost feel in a way, I mean, we all like a good review, so that's nice, but I quite welcome constructive criticism type reviews, you know, but
yeah,
you don't tend to get that, do you? You tend to get, oh, I thought this was really good, or you just get, it's shit. You know?
Well, yeah, that's it. There's no middle ground, is there?
Why is it shit? What, you know, you want to engage that person almost. So what about it did you think was shit? You know, because I want to know.
I just sometimes you see reviews where people have given something one star because they were having a bad day.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Or the parcel was torn when it came up. I've even seen that. You know?
Yeah. Oh, you get that a lot, actually. The box was torn. It's one star review on the book. It's like, you're not reviewing Amazon here, you numpty. Yeah. The best one I have is still my favourite review ever. It was a one star review for an Erie River Publishing anthology. It calls for Forest Volume 1, and it was a one star review because this idiot had bought a copy of it and took it camping with them to read to her children. This was an adult horror. And she took a screenshot, and it was a screenshot of a line from one of the stories. I forget whose story it was. And it was the line, not suitable for children. It's like nowhere on this page does it say that it is suitable for children, for goodness sake.
You wonder what's wrong with people sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So, I'm sorry, that's on you.
I heard people buying things like Pan's Labyrinth because they think it's going to be a sweet little story and playing it to their kids. And it's like, really?
Yeah.
Do you not read the back? Do you not find out what it's about before you... Or look at the, you know, if it's in this country, look at the rating.
Yes. Yeah.
But I know books don't have ratings, but it's pretty obvious usually what they are, surely.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, the cover art is usually a big clue, isn't it? And I'm surprised in a way that we haven't had that in yet, given the furore in America with albums and all that. And like you say, on DVDs, that there's no one's thought to bring in that on books yet. But I'm not quite sure how that would work, really.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it?
Because some of the scariest stories I've read, you've got virtually there's no horror in at all, particularly, but... Again, it creates that atmosphere, and then something happens.
Well, it's like The Willows, still to my mind, one of the most terrifying things I've ever read, but not a lot actually happens.
Yeah.
There's no blood, there's no guts, there's none of that. You know, it's pure atmosphere, and it's absolutely chilling. And I think that's like one of the reasons why it's endured, I think.
A story that can unsettle you is just, it's something special about that.
Definitely, yeah.
And then gore doesn't do it, you know.
No.
It's about the atmosphere. And that's what I was trying to start with.
Yeah.
Except occasionally when I'm just writing, just have a bit of fun with it. You know. I did a detective story for you recently, which it's got horror in it, but it was just fun to write.
I could tell you were having fun with that. I had fun reading it. There is one of them, you know that when you're reading a story and you start to grin, it's just like, yeah, I could say he's been having fun with this one. So,
and that was exactly what you said about playing in the sandbox. It's like, well, I've got all this stuff. I could do all this with it. And it's just like, let's just do it. And it was just, a blast.
There is a joy sometimes if it's a particular period, isn't it? I mean, an obvious one would be Victorian London. You think, oh, fog, Jack the Ripper, gaslight, cobbled streets. It's already there, isn't it? Yeah.
I've done a lot of that now because I'm an amateur ripperologist. I've been interested in Jack the Ripper since I was like a teenager. I've got hundreds of books on the subject. So any excuse to go into that sort of late Victorian, you know, filth and stick some tentacles in there, you know, any excuse, and I'm on it, you know.
Do you have a theory about who Jack the Ripper was?
My favourite is William Henry Berry, who was, he was later arrested and hung up in Aberdeen, I believe it was. He left London just after the Rose Mylett murder, which a lot of people don't see as canon, but I do. Saw it as a botched. He left with his wife and then basically ripped her up in the basement of their house. And he was a sawdust merchant and with a yard in the centre of Whitechapel, and he used to take sawdust around all the pubs, which gives him a reason to be on the streets, blah, 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 blah. I've just always seen him as more plausible because he's not one of the sensational ones. He was basically just a drunk bloke in the area, you know, a drunken, misogynistic chap who, you know, may or may not have got caught syphilis off a prostitute. So to me, he just seems plausible.
Yeah.
Do you have any, is there any era that you've not used yet that you'd like to? Or what is your favourite Lovecraftian era, do you think?
I do. I have a love of the 20s and 30s. I mean, I love the styles. I love that whole feel. But the trouble with doing historical eras is all the research.
Yes.
You know, you get so bogged down in some of the research, you forget to do the story.
Yes.
So I kind of almost like creating... One of the reasons I like doing science fiction a lot is you just create your own world of fantasy. You draw in what you like.
Yeah.
But sometimes I try and leave it slightly vague, so it almost feels timeless. Like with the detective story I wrote, I started off thinking it might be in the 50s, but then I kind of just left it vague and I put in elements that suggest it isn't, but I don't specify it to a time period. But one area I've always wanted is ancient Egypt because of my love of it. But the trouble is, having studied it at Egypt evening classes for so long, I'm almost frightened to tackle it because I know how much I don't know and how much there is to know. And
right.
So I did recently write a story which is set in a museum gallery, so I could put in an Egyptian feel but do something in present day with it. And again, I tend to do, like, I'll do ancient Egypt set in another world or on another time, so I can use elements but create a fantasy civilization that kind of mirrors rather than is the same. So that if there's any inaccuracies, I can say, well, that's because it's an alternate or an other version of it, just to give you a bit of freedom.
That reminds me of Stargate, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have really thought that first film was amazing. Yeah. So the early series was pretty good as well, actually.
Yeah. I do like the series, yeah. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, that film had a lot of potential. It looked great on the screen.
Yeah, definitely.
I suppose that accuracy thing is even more compounded when you're on a TV series or a film, isn't it? If you're setting something in like Sharp, for example, then they've got the wrong buttons or all that kind of stuff.
Whereas, yeah,
I think you can get away with it a lot more on a printed page than you can in film.
Of course, the trouble with ancient history, especially, is you write something and then 2 weeks later, a new piece of discovery comes along that changes everything. What you thought is no longer what it was. So.
I mean, to some respects, that's the same with Clark Ashton Smith, right? And his story set on Venus before we had anything, a probe going to Venus or anything. And now, you know, it's all impossible.
Yeah.
It doesn't diminish the enjoyment, I don't think, of the story.
No, because in your mind, it can just be another epoch, can't it?
Yeah.
It can be far future.
It's a parallel world where...
Future or distant past, something like that. Yeah.
It's the story that's what counts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you have any particular projects that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, I've got a few things in the works. I'm writing some new stuff that I'm hoping to send off to the No Sleep podcast. I'm waiting on a few things that I've sent off to some anthologies. I'm not really supposed to talk about those yet, though, so until I get a response. But I have also got a few things that are due to come out fairly soon, which I'm looking forward to. There's Weird Fiction Quarterly number 3, the summer edition, which I'm hoping will be out this week, if not next week. It's a collection of 500-word flash fiction, and they've got some great writers in it. And it's the third one out, which is the summer edition. And obviously, I've got working with Tim again. It was the Erie River Cosmic Horror Anthology, I think, is due to appear very soon, I think.
Yes, yeah. So it's in the works. Michelle's working on the cover as we speak. So,
wow, brilliant. Yeah. And obviously, Whisper in Valhalla's creeping up on the horizon somewhere.
Indeed.
So that'll
be yes.
Yeah.
And the Eldritch Investigations, hopefully. Is another one I'm looking forward to. I really want to read it because I want to see
it. I know, same. Yeah, no, that's with the publisher. That's just, as and when. That could be announced tomorrow. It could be announced next week. It's, imminent. Yeah.
So there are things on the horizon that are imminent, yeah. But I'm just looking forward to seeing them, really. So
yeah, same.
It's good stuff.
I think in a sense that investigator trope or setting is one of my favourites for Lovecraft, because it mixes two. I mean, well, you know, in a way, Lovecraft is made for the detective setting, right? Because it's traditionally someone uncovering clues to a particular situation or event,
yeah,
and then going mad.
I used to do a lot of the Call of Cthulhu role playing when I was probably 10 years ago. I moved away from my friends stupidly, so I don't do it as often now. But that, of course, a huge part of that game was the investigation and the uncovering of clues. And I think, yeah, I approached the detective story along that kind of line, you know, as if it were almost like a scenario.
Yeah. And we can almost read some stories like that. I mean, Shadow Over Innsmouth is a prime example, isn't it? But
yeah.
But certainly some of the other stories we've covered in the past, we've said you can see this as a scenario, you know, the way it builds.
Well, I think, yeah, August Derleth, a lot of his stuff is very similar to those scenarios, because it isn't, it's not quite as atmospheric as Lovecraft's stuff. It's more straight to the point, it's more straightforward. And I think a lot of his stuff works really well as them kind of scenarios.
Yeah.
And I think that's something mentioned, almost like this spectrum, this Lovecraftian spectrum from stories that are sort of pulpy adventures all the way through to your more sort of direct Lovecraft things. And then at the other end, you've got people like Thomas Ligotti, who I just think, how do you write like that? That's just incredible. There's not a deep one in sight or a tentacle in sight, but it is so chilling.
Yeah, Ligotti, yeah. Kin, and yeah.
So conventions is another subject that tends to come up every now and again on this show.
Do you know of any?
Well, funny enough.
I do believe there's one in September called the Innsmouth Literary Festival. So have you, Tim's been to quite a few conventions. I don't think I've been to any conventions, certainly not as a guest. Have you attended any conventions yourself, Simon?
Not this kind of convention. I obviously have done science fiction conventions, but I've never been to one like this, and never as a guest. This is going to be a very interesting experience.
All right, it's going to be new for all of us.
Yes.
except me and Anna Spark.
We're going to be looking to you to sort of know what to do.
As long as there's no sacrifice of the virgins at the end of it.
We are in Bedford, so that might be that might be a bit tough.
And don't pet the shog off. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, one reason we did it was because we look across to the States and we see Necronomicon and the Lovecraft Film Festival. They seem to have a lot of events going on, and we seem to lack that, yeah, a bit over here. So. Again, it's that idea of just getting people together to talk about weird shit.
Yeah, I think it's going to be brilliant. I'm looking forward to it. And I think it's good to get more in this country because, as you say, everything is so states-bound, and it's there's a lot of good writers over here. There's a lot of, you know, writing history here, and it's good to have that.
Yeah.
I think what's been telling has been the response to it. It's been a very positive reaction. You know, because you always have in the back of your head, don't you, when you announce something like this, that there's going to be somebody somewhere who goes, oh, what are you doing that for? You know, but there's been none of that, you know.
No.
I mean, like the response of, like, the traders and things like that has been overwhelming, really, hasn't it? I mean, that room is going to be packed with some weird and wonderful stuff.
It's got some very strange things that are going to be on sale. But, you know, it's strange in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. They said we've got everything from books and maps and, you know, the usual sort of thing, all the way to, what was it you told me about this morning? Look, Cthulhu garden gnomes?
Yeah, Cthulhu garden ornaments, which I thought was great.
That's amazing. I want some from a balcony.
and through to things in jars, which I've seen some photographs and I'm not quite sure what they are. But, you know, we all need things in jars every now and again. So.
Yeah, it's taxidermy as well, isn't it? Yeah, it's going to be very, very interesting. And like I say, yeah, and you're one of our guests, and we've got a very good lineup of that. And, yeah, I think it's going to be a very good day. So have you got any nerves about that? I think we've discussed this before.
Yeah, just a few, you know.
Yeah.
more worried about just sitting there like a rabbit in headlights, just, you know. But I think it's going to be fine. It's going to be an interesting day, great experience. And I can't wait to look around these trader stalls now. I want a thing in the jar. I'm just worried I'm going to spend all my money on books. But
yes.
That's going to be a thing, isn't it? Was it the terrible old man who put people in jars or something like that? Was it?
It was the terrible
perhaps
old man.
Perhaps that's who it is. Perhaps it's the terrible old man limited or something. I don't know.
That's amazing. Oh, they should change. If it isn't, they should change their name to that now. Yeah.
So let's finish up with a couple of questions, our quick fire round that we usually ask our guests.
Who do you think you are, Bob Holness?
I'll take a pee, please, Bob.
We mentioned film a little bit earlier on, or briefly. Lovecraftian film adaptations, possible or not, and what do you think has been the best so far?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, I know you spoke recently about Dagon with Stuart Gordon as Dagon. That's one I really like. What else? Let's think. There was Mouth of, I don't get the title right, Mouth of Madness, which was... In the Mouth, that's the one, yeah. That was an interesting one. I liked the way that went.
I actually wrote a prequel to that for Eighth Tower Records. It's in their Terrorvision anthology.
Should have that one up.
I had real fun with that because I had to watch it and I got the soundtrack, you know, because I love John Carpenter's music. So I had the soundtrack on the headphones while I'm writing it. It's just, brilliant. I really enjoyed that.
Then, of course, we had the Colour Out of Space, but I'm still not sure about the choice of Nick Cage.
Yes, same.
I think I need to watch that again. I watched it once and kind of liked it, but I know what you mean.
He's just so strange. It's just before he's meant to be strange, he's just...
Yeah, I preferred the black and white one, De Farber.
Yes.
I thought that was a much better adaptation, personally.
It's interesting that both chose the same on-screen colour for the colour, though.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an odd... choice, but it works. But I think it works better in De Farber because everything's black and white, and that's the only thing that's in colour.
Yeah,
and that makes it stand out. Whereas, maybe if the other version had done something similar, I don't know. It's a hard thing to portray.
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
and that's the challenge of Lovecraft in general, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the idea of the colour, or even creatures that just to see them brings madness. How do you replicate that?
Yeah.
It's a tough one. And in a sense, if you have Cthulhu turn up, is it just like Godzilla, really, or something?
Did you see the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society did their version of Call of Cthulhu?
Yeah, stunning. Yeah,
I like that one a lot. And it almost looked like it was from the 20s. It was just so brilliantly done.
That was very well done. Very good idea to do it in that way as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that Whisper in the Darkness was really good as well. What you're saying about it, just like Cthulhu coming across like Godzilla, I mean, a great example of that would be that fairly recent one, Underwater.
I couldn't get through that. I watched the start of it.
I liked it. I enjoyed it for what it was, but they kind of wasted the idea of it because, again, it was just like any monster with tentacles at the end. But this is Cthulhu. This is like, come on.
There wasn't much point for him being there. It was kind of like, oh, he's just there. Okay. And it didn't really tie into any of the mythology in any way. It was just like, it's just a monster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's the problem. It's just a kraken or something. It could have just been, couldn't it? You know?
And that's the challenge again, isn't it? Is making it more than a monster movie. Because I mean, Lovecraft's full of monsters, right? Deep ones and ghouls and all the rest of it. But that's not the main point.
It needs a very strong visual atmosphere to really to work, I think, as well.
Yeah. I mean, something like Jacob's Ladder, in a way, would be more of a Lovecraftian film.
Oh, that was a great film.
I've not seen the remake, but I don't know what that is like.
I didn't even know there was a remake, is there? Oh, God. And I'm very dubious. That's one of my favourite films of all time. I watched that at the cinema when it came out. It freaked me out.
So where can people get in touch with you, or where can people find you on the internet?
I've got an Amazon author page where they can look at my work, and I've got a there's a Facebook group, The Stories of Simon Bleak, and it's set to private to keep trolls out, but people who are really interested are always welcome in.
Nice.
Yeah, don't feed the trolls. Yeah, I've had that problem with my public group for my radio show and club night. Every day, it's the same damn spam post about Simon Cowell going into hospital or something.
Oh, yes, I've
Yeah,
seen
it
that.
just keeps popping up. It's just like I keep blocking these people. It was bots, right? And there must be hundreds of them. Why they're all coming to me, I don't know.
I've noticed it on one of the Robert E. Howard groups that I'm on. There's a constant stream of people saying, "Hi, I really love this stuff. I'm glad to have joined." And again, it's very dubious as to whether they're real people or not.
Yeah.
But,
Yeah.
you know, are any of.
It's an invasion of spam bots at the moment, definitely.
Yeah. Again, you can almost see that AI scenario, can't you? You don't know who you're talking to anymore or what you're talking
Yeah.
to.
You get the dubious friend requests, and you think, really? Okay.
Yes. Oh, yeah. The porn ones are the ones that the ones that always get me. They're always so very badly spelt, and the grammar's terrible. So that's the first thing I notice as a writer, you know. Not looking at the profile picture. It's like,
Proofreading
yeah, I'm proofreading the blurb.
That's a similar thing, you know, because one of my day jobs is teaching like fitness and health and qigong and all that kind of thing. And I knew I was getting older when someone said, "Oh, she's nice looking." Yeah, terrible posture. You know? And do you find this as well? It gets a bit hard to read something without sometimes critiquing it as you go along because
Yes,
you half read
absolutely.
it, as like you say, as a writer or an editor, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. I do with video games because I play a lot of like indie games, which are quite low budget. A lot of them are made like in different countries, so they have an English translation. And often the translation is terrible. So it really takes me out of the experience where I'm just like going, that comma's in the wrong place. I should be concentrating on what's going on, but I'm not. I'm just like, that comma's in the wrong place. That's not how you spell that. It's just, ooh, stop it. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, I hear the big yellow bus has pulled up outside, so it's time for us to depart Innsmouth. Not for Simon, of course, because as we said before, he gets the full Innsmouth After Dark experience. So check that bolt, push that wardrobe across the door. I'm sure you'll be fine.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming in, Simon. It's been a pleasure to look into it.
Nice to chat to you both.
Thanks, man.
So it just remains for us to say a big thank you to our listeners for today and to Simon for coming in. And of course, a big thank you to all our supporters and patrons. If you'd like to join them, then check out our site at Patreon, where you can sign up at three levels of membership. And remember, you can also sign up now on Buzzsprout at the Acolyte level, which gets you bonus content for both the Innsmouth Book Club and Strange Shadows. You get a quarterly copy of Innsmouth News, and you get free entry to that wonderful event we were talking about earlier on. We're going to be in the Gillman Hotel on our next visit as well. We have another guest coming in, Mr. Paul Fricker of Chaosium and good friends of Jackson Elias, a podcast fame, is going to be coming in for a chat. So we look forward to that. Thanks again to Simon. That's it from me, Rob Poynton.
And that's it from me, Tim Mendes.